I'm really pleased to introduce Anne Burroughs, is the interim president and CEO of the Japanese American National Museum. She is also chair of the board of directors of Amnesty International USA and serves on the International Council of the Global Organization. As a young activist in her native South Africa, she was imprisoned as a result of her anti-apartheid activism until Amnesty International helped secure her release. She is now an internationally recognized human rights leader and speaker, an all-around pretty brilliant and good person. Please give a warm welcome to Ms. Anne Burroughs.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, we're going to jump right into our program this evening, and I'd like to introduce our panelists who are visiting with us at Zocalo tonight. First, we have on the furthest from me is Hiroshi Motomura, who is a scholar of immigration and citizenship law at UCLA School of Law. He's also the author of Americans in Waiting: The Lost Story of Immigration and Citizenship in the United States. And then next to him from DC, we have Ali Nourani, who's the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. And he's also the author of the forthcoming book, There Goes the Neighborhood: How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. And then next to me, we have Lane Hirabayashi, who is a sociocultural anthropologist at UCLA's Department of Asian American Studies, where he's also the inaugural chair in Japanese American Incarceration, Redress, and Community. So with us tonight, we have, I think, really a quite extraordinary panel that is going to walk us right back into the eye of history and point to its lessons from the present as we have a conversation and talk about what the Japanese American experience can tell us about the proposed Muslim registry. I'd like to just start off by saying that, you know, it's no accident that the program this evening is taking place here at the Japanese American National Museum, but also on the site where in 1942 Los Angeles Japanese American community was forced to board buses that would take them to concentration camps around the country. So we're here on the site of the museum, which stands as a sentinel. The promise of the museum is that what happened to the Japanese Americans must never happen again. It mustn't happen to any group of people, regardless of ethnicity, religion, etc. So here we are with President-elect Donald Trump advocating for a Muslim registry. We're facing the specter of that terrible, tragic episode in American history being repeated, that saw the exclusion of 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry, the majority of whom were American citizens, excluded and incarcerated in concentration camps. So we've heard the rhetoric, we've heard the discussions, you know, we've heard the policy, the conversation evolved over the course of the campaign. You know, we've heard his surrogates speak directly to this. We heard Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach talk about specifically about a Muslim database. We heard Carl Higbee cite the Japanese American camps as a precedent. And then most recently, just in the last couple of days, we heard President-elect Trump talk about, you know, when he was asked by reporters about a Muslim ban and registry in response to the bombings in Berlin and Turkey, he said, "You've known my plans all along." We have a president-elect making these statements. If we look back in, you know, the recent history, we have Ronald Reagan in 1988 apologizing for what happened to Japanese Americans. We have the War Relocation Commission in 1982 finding unequivocally that there was absolutely no reason for the incarceration to have happened. There was no military imperative, there was no sabotage, there was no espionage. It was purely and simply war hysteria, prejudice and poor political leadership. So I guess my question, I mean, it's hard to talk about this issue without having a deeply emotional response. But when we hear it being framed as policy, it's framed in the context of keeping us more secure. So I think that's really the first question that I want to ask you is, does something like this actually make us more secure? Whomever wants to take that question.
Since we're here at the museum and Japanese American history is part of the construct of this particular issue, I think it's really important to start with two points. One is that there wasn't just one registry of Japanese Americans, but there were numerous ones carried out for different kinds of purposes at different times. And I think at the end of the war, when the smoke had cleared, the U.S. government was not able to prosecute one person successfully for sabotage or espionage. And you look at the thousands of lives that were impacted, damaged by curfew, then mass removal, and then incarceration. I think it's really tragic. And I'm so glad to see people interested in revisiting this history, because I think it's a real lesson book for what needs to be thought of and what needs to be avoided in terms of public policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if I think about this in terms of more recent, I mean, I agree with what Lane is saying, but if you think about this in terms of more recent history and what happened post 9/11, you know, you had the so-called NSEERS, National Security Exit Entry Registration System, and it really was a compulsory registration program focused on Arab and Muslim countries in North Korea. It didn't involve all non-citizens, but it was clearly targeting in this way. And it turned out really to be more of an immigration sweep than anything else. But its results in terms of actual security prosecutions was really quite minimal, and that's what led the Department of Homeland Security to essentially put it into dormancy, and then most recently President Obama rescinded the regulations. And last point on this is that the person who was essentially the mastermind, I guess, or the person who sort of instigated this in terms of John Ashcroft's Department of Justice was Kris Kobach, who was now as part of remains to be seen what his actual role will be, but it certainly has had the ear of the president-elect for quite some time, including back into the quite far back in the campaign.
And Hiroshi, isn't it true that they were able to register something like 70 or 80,000,
right,
or maybe you know this, Ali, persons? But I heard that also, after a decade
right,
of this
right.
kind of intelligence work, there was not one person
yeah.
deported or you know, deport on the basis of sabotage or espionage.
Well, they're deported on the basis
right.
of selective prosecution, essentially going after people out of the 11 million people or so, millions of people in this country who are in the country without lawful status, which is a whole other topic which we can get into. But it was a very focused sort of thing. And I also think it was quite evident that John Ashcroft said at the time, we're essentially going to use the immigration system mm-hmm. to go after people who might be.
Right.
So to answer your question, these programs have no meaning in terms of actual national security. So NSEERS put 80,000 people mm-hmm. through the system, ended up deporting approximately 3,000 people based on immigration violations, and no individual who went through the system was prosecuted or found as any sort of a terrorist mm-hmm. risk. What does that mean moving forward, I think, is the bigger question, right? Mm-hmm. Because even though President Obama has in essence rescinded has destroyed the program can be recreated mm-hmm. Very, very quickly. The best thing about the Obama administration taking the regulations off the books is that if the Trump administration moves forward, it has to be done in a way that we all know about it. And I think as the conversation moves forward this evening, the change in, I think, Americans' understanding of the Muslim community, the issue of terrorism, that is going to be challenged. That's going to be the biggest mm-hmm. challenge for us moving forward.
Mm-hmm. So, Lane, do you want to talk a little bit about what you see as being the differences that there are now from what they were, just in terms of the kind of predictions and the sort of solidarity and the fact that that kind of coalition working in unison, that there are so many groups that are saying this must never happen again. I mean, in 1942, there were really only the Quakers that stood up for the Japanese Americans. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I wish I was more knowledgeable on this one, but just in terms of the Japanese American community, I've been really pleased, delighted even to see the different Japanese American community organizations that have come forward and taken a stand on this, from the Japanese American Citizens League, which I think has been more of a traditional civil rights organization, to some of my friends and colleagues in the National Coalition for Redress and Reparations that was renamed as the Nikkei for Civil Rights and Reparations. I think they've been courageous and outstanding in terms of providing leadership not only in Southern Cal and for the region, but nationally in terms of trying to reach out to a whole range of organizations, because I think that that's the kind of coalition building that's going to be needed.
Right. So on December 5th, when candidate Trump, December 5th of last year, when candidate Trump made his first statement in favor of really a ban on Muslim immigration, I was actually going from Mexico City to here to Los Angeles, and I land in Los Angeles that day, kind of see my Twitter feed just kind of get slammed, and I think, wow, you know, I'm kind of like the Trump trifecta. You know, I just came from Mexico City, I'm a Muslim, and I advocate for undocumented immigrants. Sam, we're winning here. But what happened over the course of those the weeks and the months after that statement was actually quite remarkable, because yes, we saw an outpouring of support for the Muslim community from the progressive left, from the liberal left, from Democrats. But we as an organization do a lot of work with conservatives and moderates. And you know, when the Southern Baptist Convention stood up and said, for the sake of religious liberty, you know, we cannot be in support of a government or that bans a religion, I just came to realize that, okay, this is a different America. And it's not an America that I think many of us in California, to terribly stereotype the audience, sorry.
Our bubble, right?
Right. Yeah. But I mean, we've gotten to know some of the folks who have these mega Southern Baptist mega churches who are just as worried about a Muslim registry as probably most of us here in this room.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's explore a little bit this sort of issue of climate. You know, the climate that creates this. You know, we know from history, Lane, the climate that gave rise to this, that made it permissive. You know, the parallels between what we were hearing then, what we were seeing then, and what we're seeing now.
Yeah.
Because that's really what makes it that, you know, once that climate is sufficiently powerful, it then becomes permissive and it becomes normal.
Well, I think the three variables you cited from the CWRIC Commission hearings, the Commission on the Wartime Internment of Civilians, is very apropos to this. And as you listed, it had to do with a history of prejudice and discrimination being kind of one of the background variables. War hysteria, you know, conflict, and then failure of leadership. I think those are still three elements from the historical past. And yeah, many things have changed, but unfortunately, I see those things eddying in the policy discussions that are being put forward still today. There's the different groups are the target of these, and that's of deep concern.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to look at it from the perspective of someone who's studied immigration and citizenship, the law of immigration and citizenship in this country has always been a site of discrimination of various kinds. We have China's exclusion laws. We have the exclusion of African Americans from citizenship itself. We had a lot of hysteria in the 1800s about Catholics and the concern that Catholics could never truly owe allegiance to this country because they owed allegiance to the Pope instead. That was the widely spread view. And so in these times, as we see with the Japanese American experience, that that there's two things going on. I mean, one was the use of immigration and citizenship law to exclude on the basis of race. Another is, at the same time and invidiously, the fact that people were citizens was not enough to protect them. So what really meant was that, you know, citizenship is, and the immigration laws are used as a barrier to keep you out. But if that doesn't work, the fact that you're a citizen really doesn't count for as much as you thought. Mm-hmm. And that's a sense that I certainly had after 9/11, actually, right? That it wasn't citizenship that was protective anymore. And the last piece of the, for now that I'll throw out as far as the history of immigration and citizenship law in this country is not only that has it been a site of discrimination, but it's been a site of strongly discretionary enforcement. In other words, we have a system that has acquiesced in millions of people having their labor relied on to keep this economy going. And that creates a situation where the enforcement tap can be turned on or off. That's happened post 9/11 against the people targeted through NSEERS. It's happened with a lot of working people from Latin America, and it happened with Chinese laborers in the 19th century. And so that's another bit of a cycle. So it's partly, in a sense, the manipulation of law. Mm-hmm. So you can target the people that you want among the many people that you've allowed to come in violation.
And I think that the environment today is, to state the obvious, it's very different than it was 5 or 10 years ago. And I just have to say that this is the first event I've ever spoken at that has its own beer cozy.
Okay. It's got water in it.
Right, it's got water in it.
You didn't get the beer.
But what I'm getting at is that I think that the majority of Americans are supportive of immigrants and immigration, but they're also scared. And I think that we have to understand and acknowledge that fear. Because any time now that any of us open the newspaper, we read about what's happening in the Middle East, we read about what's happening in Central America. Mm-hmm. And for many Americans, when they see that story of that family fleeing Syria, they assume that that family is going to show up next door, right? When they see that woman and her child fleeing the Northern Triangle, they assume that they're going to be in the school that their child goes to the next day. So there's that closeness of the immigration debate, or not even so much the immigration debate, but the migration conversation, that I think creates an environment that is both very humanizing, but also very scary. And if an incident, a tragic incident, was to occur in the next 4 years, we're going to see, you know, how far the pendulum has really swung. Because I think that, you know, right now when you've got people like, you know, Mayor Garcetti, de Blasio, and mayors across the country, and their law enforcement officials saying, you know, we're going to stand up and protect the immigrant community and the Muslim community, they're going to be challenged at that moment. And I think we're all going to be challenged. And it gets to your point of, you know, what's the political leadership that we can depend on at the national level, much less at the local level?
Mm-hmm. And let me just pick up on a theme that's in the conversation, but I just want to identify to something that's really important. I'm not sure this I have a particular argument here, but it's really the regional aspect of this. Mm-hmm. You know, that a lot of we've had, and this goes back to your comment about the bubble or whatever that may be, you know, and I've, in my time in dealing with this as a scholar and to some extent an advocate, I lived in Colorado, North Carolina, and in Los Angeles. I can assure you these are very, very different local conversations. And one of the interesting things about the politics we have today, and it really goes to the question of what would happen, right? Or even what is happening now, is how much of it is locally driven. It's an interesting kind of a juxtaposition, because on the one hand, you think you're in a bubble, but you're also at the epicenter, right? So at the same time, it really cuts both ways. I'm also thinking about some of the election results we see in places, not just in the United States, but I was in Europe. I was in Germany at the time when Angela Merkel's party lost the really diminished in their take of the vote in her home home state, and is of course it, well not of course I shouldn't say that it was the region of Germany with the fewest immigrants and the fewest refugees, and so there's a kind of a funny juxtaposition of the regionalism. I also contrast that to Proposition 187 in California in 1994, where clearly the politics of California on the questions of immigration and immigrants' rights is quite different as it is now, both, I think, among the voting public and in the political leadership, for example, in the state legislature or in the governor's office.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I'm interested, I always think about the bubble, you know, I always think about the bubble, but, you know, I'm interested to hear, to sort of explore a little bit about this notion of we're in the bubble, but we're actually at the epicenter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we're in a bubble, if we're sort of in a bubble of liberalism or whatever, you know, that's going to have to be where some of that, you know, some of the action develops, the kind of nation, the sort of, you know, the nascent actions, protections, or whatever that are going to have to be mounted against this. So, I'd be interested to get back to that question. You know, Ali, that we talked about earlier on is what do we do? You know, what do we do about this? You know, here we are, and I think the regionalization thing is really important. You know, California is a pretty powerful bloc. What can we actually do? I mean, we have our mayors, we have people that are standing up and talking about, you know, sanctuary cities, etc. But there's always that threat hanging over of that incident, that massive incident that might actually shift public opinion that you referred to. So what do we do? What kind of action do we do? How do we coalesce around this? Mm-hmm. What is realistic that we as people in this room can do?
Good.
I would have to say that of the questions you asked us to think about, that's probably the most difficult one. I mean, at some level, I think just being able to take a stand that any kind of policy that massifies people in terms of their religious background, their national origins, their race, if you will, is just fundamentally not what this country is about. And to just look at the various means that might be available or suitable to try and follow that commitment.
I think there are two things that we should be doing. One is that I think it's our responsibility to challenge our assumptions. And number two, I think that we should be looking to meet people where they are, but not leave them there. And what do I mean by that? I have no idea. But they sound great, don't they? What I mean by this is that, I mean, I think we all have assumptions about what people outside of our respective bubbles think mm-hmm. and feel and believe. And as a result of those assumptions, we don't kind of get out of our own comfort zones and meet folks. So, for example, you use the term sanctuary cities. Mm. You know, 99% of the people that we work with, when they hear the term sanctuary cities, bells and flags go off. And it, number one, there's no such thing as a sanctuary city. Mm-hmm. And number two, it gives a sense of lawlessness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I was advising, you know, Mayor Garcetti, I would say, you know what, Los Angeles is not a sanctuary city. It's a city that believes in smart law enforcement. And smart law enforcement depends on the trust that police officers have with their immigrant community. So I think we have to understand the language that we use mm-hmm. and how other people interpret and respond to that language. And the other piece of this is that as we are kind of going down that path and as incidents come up, I think we also have to understand what is President Trump likely to say, mm-hmm. right? He's going to use that, he's very likely to use that moment and that tragedy to polarize the country. So I think in that case, it is incredibly important for the non-immigrant community to be speaking to the value of the immigrant community or the Muslim community, because mm-hmm. that's the deal that, you know, a President Trump will try to exploit at that moment. And I think we have to make the case to the public that immigrants, immigration, Muslims are a good deal for the American worker and their family.
Yeah, let me give two answers that are come from different parts of my personality, I have to say. I mean, one of them is that looking back on some experiences I had moderating town hall meetings on this question of not so much, just of immigration policy generally in North Carolina. I mean, I agree with the way you put it in terms of the value of immigration. But it was interesting to me how many very precise and focused falsehoods or myths that were floating around out there, like people here without status, or the term, you know, they said, well, illegal aliens don't pay any taxes, do they? And therefore, here's my question. And so, I suppose it's an occupational hazard as a teacher to think that if you could only, you know, get the truth out there, that everyone would agree with you. I'm not sure that really works, but I think that there are people for whom that matters. I often think about who my audience is, right, when we write or when we speak. You know, and I realize that there are probably people I won't reach, but there's a lot of reasonable people, I think, the conversation will be very productive with. I also think that it's interesting in terms of the timeline, just to think about the timeline of Japanese American incarceration and how I guess that was over 70 years ago and. But NCERS is really very recent. We've got the same people involved, right? And so the other part of me, this is the other part of my personality, is that I think that there's a legal playbook that is very, you know, ready to go. I think it's going to require a lot of support. And some of it's going to be in the nature of individual defense, and some of it is going to be in the nature of actually saying, you know, this violates the Constitution. And if you weren't willing to say it in the 1940s, you need to say it now.
And somewhat similar to this and what I was saying earlier is the concept of religious liberty. I think over the last 10 years, the public has come to realize that Muslims are part of a religion called Islam. It is not a racial or ethnic category. And I'm not saying that it's, you know, 100% agreement there, but there's at least a debate. Mm-hmm. So we were part of some work in South Carolina, kind of speaking outside of the bubble, where the South Carolina state legislature started to move legislation that would have, in essence, required any refugee who came to the state to register with the state, and then held any organization that resettled the refugee in South Carolina liable if that individual was to commit a crime moving forward. So most of your refugee resettlement organizations in the U.S. are faith-based organizations, World Relief, World Vision, Catholic Charities. So we put together this coalition in South Carolina that included the Catholics, the Lutherans, the evangelical community, the Southern Baptists, and others, the ACLU, progressive organizations. And what was their common thread? Religious liberty. And I will guarantee you, if for most of us in the room, if we had thought about agreeing to protect religious liberty, our mind immediately would have raced to LGBT rights. Or the way that the gay marriage debate has been defined. And I'm not, you know, casting judgment one way or another. I'm just saying that different parts of the American public interpret these things differently or in different ways. So we have to, as we move forward, think about the common set of values that can advance the issues that we care about. And we found that when it came to the resettlement of Syrian refugees in the Deep mm-hmm. South, mm-hmm. it was about religious liberty.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Lane, do you want to talk a little bit about the insights that you might have from the Japanese-American experience from 1942? Parallels the lessons. Sure. The lessons, so what we need to understand sure. from that and take with us.
I think one thing that I could come up with was this notion of a registry. And looking at the historic record, it's pretty clear to me that registries or the making of lists was a process and a pretty ongoing process. So I think some of the way that the debate's been framed in the national media is very misleading, because when you look at Japanese Americans and you say registry, well, what registry are we talking about? Because we have things like the Smith Act that would require the registration of you know, foreign nationals, for example, well before camp. Or is Higbee talking about something like the registry of Japanese Americans carried out after Executive Order 9066 that was done after an executive order as a prelude to removing people from their neighborhoods and putting them in these temporary camps, right? There are those kinds of things. And when even when Japanese Americans were put in camps, there were various questionnaires and registries. I'm thinking of the loyalty, so-called loyalty questionnaire of 1944 that was supposed to lead to information about whether people that were incarcerated in these various camps or interned in Justice Department camps were actually Americans, loyal Americans, trying to get at their Americanness somehow, that I think was also pretty much of a dismal failure. And I think in terms of relating it today, one of the conundrums for me is we don't really know what's going on with surveillance and registries now. All I get is things that they're able to release on like CNN, where they're talking about maybe 15, at least 15 different known intelligence agencies. And I should have double-checked this, but I heard also on CNN the quote that the United States spends something like on the order of maybe 100 million, I think it was. I had down in my notes 100 billion, but it can't be. Maybe yeah. Someone will remember having seen the same program. But that's a lot of agencies, and that's a lot of money. And I would just bet dimes to donuts that there are already plenty of registries looking at immigrants coming in, looking at people coming from Middle Eastern countries, looking at people in terms of Islam. I think there's plenty of this stuff, given the amount of budget that we, the taxpayer, are laying out for this now. I don't think that the cases in the 1940s suggest that this was very efficacious or produced any tangible information that would help us to defend ourselves. But the conundrum for me is we don't know. Yeah. It's shrouded by national security, military, you know, national defense. And I think the citizenry can't have a debate about what's going on because we're not told what's going on. And I find that deeply frustrating.
Well, you know, the when the government put the NSEERS program into dormancy over time, and in fact, very recently when it was officially dismantled in terms of the regulations being rescinded, one of the reasons officially given was that the growth of surveillance and databases had gotten to the point now where they had all the information that they were getting under the registration program. So it's an interesting sort of rationale that you've got to it sort of raises an other sets of thoughts. And the thoughts that one of the thoughts it raises in my mind is, as Lane suggests, I mean, the information is out there, and as long as we have an immigration system that is so selective in who it lets into this country, therefore so selective in who it enforces against, and therefore runs so much on discretion, then we don't quite know how that information is going to be used. And by the way, the reason I'm putting this in terms of how the immigration system works in general is because I think there's a strong commonality between the discretionary enforcement that might be evident in a registry, as we're talking about tonight, but also the kinds of immigration enforcement that take place, you know, in raids at workplaces, things like that, against this is the other part of the incoming administration's campaign promises or rhetoric having to do with deporting 11 million, 3 million, you know, whatever that may be. Anyway, that's my sense of what we've got with surveillance, but it doesn't diminish the concerns I have about how it's going to be used.
So I just have to say that, you know, personally, I am very comfortable with the idea of my government having information that I don't know about. And I'm not going to sit here pretending that I know all the programs and everything that they're doing, but I do feel comfortable with the idea that, you know, our federal government is protecting our best interests. And, you know, I think that the tension that we feel in this conversation and in the room around this issue is real and it's healthy, and it's a tension that we should continue to, you know, keep moving and have this debate. But I don't want, you know, I just feel like, you know, security is a good thing. And, you know, it's the job of the government to have this information. One thing that we haven't talked about in terms of what a Trump administration can do, and he talked about this over the course of the election or the campaign, is to is to in essence halt immigration from a particular country. Mm-hmm. NSEERS, for example, focused on 25 countries. 24 of those countries are Muslim countries. The one non-Muslim majority country is North Korea. So in essence, it did target Muslim countries without, but they included North Korea to kind of, you know, take, address the huge amount of migrants from North Korea. Right. But correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it's section 212 of the Immigration Nationality Act, 212F, I have no idea what the rest of it is about, that talks about the ability of the president to, in essence, mm-hmm. halt immigration from a particular country that he deems a national threat. That, mm-hmm. We feel, is something that a Trump administration could, in essence, make use of at any point in time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there, the ability to raise constitutional challenges to admissions questions is mm-hmm. is quite limited. Interestingly, though, I mean, the courts in the past generation, a couple generations, have left an opening, saying, which I've always thought has been an opening left to the egregious case, this might be it. I also think that the First Amendment issues, the religious aspect, religious liberty aspects, would be ones that really would provide a method of constitutional challenge that would not be present. The difficulty there, of course, is that is not only is that we're including North Korea, but also that one of the courts that upheld NCRs pointed to the fact that NCRs did not operate against Muslims right. from non-designated right. countries, right? Yeah. So this is part of the problem. I mean, is that what people say and what people are thinking and the support that they derive is not necessarily what is on the record with regard to what could be challenged. Although it's interesting that how much is on the record in this particular case. Mm-hmm. You know, and one thing I just want to mention, which I think builds on that, but it's something we haven't really explicitly named, I just want to throw it out here, is that a lot of my concern has really been not what the government does, but what the government enables others yeah. to do through various forms of incitement, yep. permission, tolerance. And so I think that government officials can make statements and say, well, I didn't really mean that. Yep. But in fact, you know, this is the reason why we have rises in hate crimes after inflammatory rhetoric, even though at some level, I suppose, the person with the rhetoric making those statements could say, well, I didn't really mean that. You know, part of me is a big part of me is more worried about the not just the polarization, but really the enabling of vigilantism, privatization of decision making, things that would go beyond what it is that we want our government to be able to do on our behalf. Mm-hmm. Just want to name that as a theme here.
I mean, that, you know, I'm interested to explore this, you know, the point that you made about information and, you know, that you're okay with having the kind of level of that the government has this kind of level of information. You know, I'd like to just explore a little bit to my mind, what's troubling is the discretionary use of that information. Because, you know, if we certainly look back at the Japanese American experience and if we look at other countries, how that information has been used specifically to target particular individuals, to round up large groups of people, and to be able to, you know, forcibly remove large groups of people. So it's really that is so unbelievably troubling about this. And, you know, certainly the parallels with the Japanese American experience are just so evident, because it was having that registry and knowing who people were and knowing where people lived and who their families were that enabled them to.
I think there are some societal values that we want our government to uphold. And I think that we are worried about this incoming administration and the values that they will utilize to, mm-hmm. whether it's using data in a discretionary fashion, enforcing the law in a discretionary fashion. And that's, I think, where what the tension is. I don't think that, you know, if we're going to sit here and say the government should not collect data mm-hmm. on individuals, that is ignoring where the majority of Americans are. And I don't think that's what we were getting at.
No, that's not what I'm right? saying. But it's really how that's used, totally used agree. Or abused. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this whole concern about a trigger moment, that's something very real to me, that they have this information. What happens in terms of the initial roundup right after Pearl Harbor is that there are at least three known agencies that were collecting data about the Japanese American community: the Justice Department through the FBI, the Navy through the Office of Naval Intelligence, and G2, which is Army Intelligence. But they were fairly, as I understand it, separated kinds of intelligence operations. They weren't consolidated. You have Pearl Harbor, and then things get consolidated, and they develop the so-called A, B, C list. You know, A is very, very dangerous and should be immediately swept up and arrested, which they did, not only with Japanese, but with Germans and Italians. A B list, which was pretty highly suspicious, and a C list. But it was that trigger moment that I think goes into operation on the kinds of registries. And many people are thinking that the U.S. Census was also complicit, because actually, what is a registry but a list? And who makes those lists in this country? The U.S. Census Bureau. And they have always denied being partisan or political. But I think evidence trickles out about every 5 or 10 years that another level of census is revealed to have been put into operation as far as identifying where Japanese Americans were residing on the West Coast and so forth. So I think that that's kind of a concern, is yes, every government's going to be collecting data of all kinds. Now they're super potential in terms of the range and the masses of data that can be collected. But I just sometimes I'm thinking with bated breath, if anything happens, that's when you're going to see the information consolidated and utilized, and I would say to the disadvantage. You know, hopefully the legal community, ACLU and other people will be able to step in and intervene, but that's when the kind of the war mentality, the garrison mentality of, oh, we got to do something to protect ourselves. It's a bad formula.
Yeah, and one of the things I think it's worth thinking about in terms of how that would happen, in terms of this trigger moment, is it's not the question of, I raised a moment ago, between inside the government and what the government enables, but really within government. I mean, I think a lot of the history of these events shows that what happens in these situations is that you have different government agencies pitted against each other, and some of them acquire greater power as a result of events, and some of them have powers that diminish. And so let me give you a different example that might be more from general sort of immigration policy, but I think it's something also very much in the news today. Something that even President Obama brought up in his news conference today, and that is the DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's often attacked by the people who oppose it as something that went beyond what Congress authorized the president to do. Mm-hmm. It's a question of Congress versus the president. But actually, a lot of what I think drove Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals was having to control rogue officers in the field who were ignoring discretionary guidelines for immigration enforcement. And so a lot of what we have in these moments is an enabling of private misbehavior, but I also think that it's important to be vigilant about exactly what's going on within government, different agencies, and it's also there too that perhaps states and local governments, to the extent that they are governments in some sense, have some kind of moderating influence. I mean, I don't want to be too sanguine about that, but I want to nuance what it means to be in the government. Right. And to understand the politics of that, because it also goes to what Ali is saying about sort of different audiences and different pressure points where it's really the person who needs to be empowered, I suppose, by public opinion is the Office of the Inspector General.
Right.
Or one agency versus another.
So I
so
think
we've
that
got go ahead. we've sort of I'm getting the wrap-up signal.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to give you just a couple of moments each just to say some closing remarks, and then we're going to actually open it up to questions from our audience. So,
well, maybe I'll just bounce off of Hiroshi to add a commentary, which it's none other than J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, who was initially opposed in the government debates about the need for mass incarceration, at least of Japanese Americans on the West Coast. It is J. Edgar Hoover that's saying, no, we don't need to do this. J., you know, and then Biddle, Arthur, his name, Arthur Biddle, the attorney general, was another one who, I guess, told Roosevelt and the people in the on the military side, this is unconstitutional. We can't do mass incarceration. So it's really true that when you look at the internal government debates, they were not of one mind. And to me, it's interesting that the justice and the FBI are two of the initial opponents of the public policy of mass incarceration.
I think that the policy questions or the policy issues behind these questions are incredibly important, as are the political questions. And I think if there is that trigger moment, those the legal strategies and every all those nooks and crannies of the policy framework are going to be incredibly or just crucial to how this all unfolds. But before that, and even at that moment, this is really a debate about culture and values. And you know, kind of go back to this issue, this example of religious liberty. That is a cultural question. That's a values question. And if we can continue to move the needle based on these issues of culture and values, then when there is that trigger moment, there's a little bit more space to have a political and a policy discussion. And I'm not sure we've done that work. And I think that's mm-hmm. that continues to be our challenge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just one quick thing about J. Edgar Hoover, though. It's interesting, J. Edgar Hoover got started as the person who was the semi-mid-level person in that instigated the Palmer raids, the Red Scare raids in the 20s. But yeah, to get to the culture and values, I think one of the things I often think about here, and this is more of a reflection than a closing observation, but...
this will have to be it.
I think we're a different country than we were even 10 years ago or 15 years ago. I mean, I think about growing up in San Francisco in the 60s and think about sort of what it meant to be a Japanese American at that time and how when I decided to go to law school, I was one of the very few, you know, Asian Americans in law school. You know, lots of stories. A lot of us in this room have these stories, right? I mean, in any place like Los Angeles, and so I have a lot of faith in the community being, you know, being attentive to the need to think about sort of what the shared values are. But a lot of this country is a place where many things that were exotic or beyond imagination. 30 or 40 years ago are quite what we expect and we expect of each other. And I do take some comfort in that as much as I'm also understand and really have deep concerns.
And I just wanted to say that I actually feel very optimistic because our community does understand and has built a lot of coalition and support. But one thing I am very, very worried about, and I want to ask a question of the panelists, is to explain a little bit more about the countering violence extremism program, and which was part of the Department of Homeland Security. And I think, as Lane has said, you know, there's so much surveillance and so much that took place in the Japanese community registries, et cetera. And I would think that the community, the Muslim community especially, would be very concerned about those kinds of programs. And the question is, what do you know about those? What has been the response, and what should be our response?
I know a little bit about the program. There's a friend both in D.C. who works with the State Department, but then also another colleague in Houston who've done some work with the program. And my understanding is that at least the part of the CVE program that I've come to know of is more prevention. So that as Muslim youth are growing up, and frankly, they're being recruited by unsavory elements, there is a counter message that's being presented. So I'm admitting to you that's just probably one slice of that program. But I do know that one component of it is really preventing the isolation and then the extremism of youth.
Mr. Morimuro, you made a reference to how the president has the ability to block immigration from specific countries, I believe that's what you said. I was wondering, is there any legal precedent to have the president block large groups of people, not just from a specific country?
Without statutory authority.
Okay.
You know, I'm not sure to what extent that particular section of the statute's been relied upon. The president has a lot of power and has gone beyond what the statute expressly authorizes to admit refugees. The president has acted to prevent the arrival of Haitians to this country. I mean, that would be one that is not so much in the exactly your question, but I think that it functionally, when I guess this would have been under First President Bush, that we have interdiction of Haitians coming to this country. It wasn't saying we're not going to let Haitians in, but it is saying that we're going to deploy the Coast Guard to make sure that Haitians can't get to this country to claim asylum, which is so that would be an example. That came under court challenge with, I think it's fair to say, mixed results. And then different administrations, including the Clinton administration, modified that and then expanded it to some extent for Cubans. And so, but that would be an example of something. And that's an interesting sort of thing as an example, because it is an example of something that is being done with a practical effect of making it hard to come in, as opposed to saying we're just going to not let any Haitians in. And so one of the things that you've seen in the campaign rhetoric is extreme vetting. What does that actually mean? Is that really a ban, or is it just making it really difficult, super difficult? And what message does that send?
Next question is on your left.
And I wanted to raise a question about the issue of an action strategy or an action in response. And perhaps I'm hopelessly naive, but somehow when the notion of a Muslim registry was being bandied about, I had this impression that people would be required to register, that it would not be voluntary, but I wasn't taking into account the existence of vast networks of surveillance and existing lists. And so one of the responses from the communities that I'm part of is, they're going to count Muslims, they're going to have to take my name too. You know, we'll all just add our names to such a list. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know what your response is. If you think, you know, oh, well, that's absurd because they don't need people to sign up. Or if you think this is a way that others of us can express solidarity, or if you think it's hazardous.
I'm really a cynic. I think that when World War II broke out, they knew how to round up the Japanese Americans. It was all a done deal. And that's, you know, that's the 40s. Can you imagine the amount of so I think the whole thing of this Muslim registry was like a political trial balloon. Because I think they totally know. They, you know, I just don't believe that they don't have tracking on everyone coming in.
Yeah. So I mean, I would say, and we've gotten this question quite a bit, and kind of given the age that we live in, and I agree with you. Like, if they make this decision, you know, you can go and stand in line, but there's nobody going to be on the other side of that. I think that, you know, using digital media. You know, I think some of the response, for example, in Spain, after incidents occurred in Spain, where there was just an outpouring of public support for the Muslim and the immigrant community in the country, those are the things that I think will, frankly, be noticed by a President Trump. He will notice when public opinion shifts against what he takes action, the actions that he takes.
My name is David Adams, and first of all, thank you very much for being here. I guess my question isn't so much on an organizational level, but a personal level. You know, just a tiny bit of context. My parents got married in New York in the late 60s. If my parents had gotten married in maybe some less urban part of the country, might be a lot more difficult for them. But conversion, kind of epiphanies of people over time, means that my parents could live pretty much in any part of the country right now, whereas in 68, that may not have been possible. So to get back to our subject at hand, you know, as an extreme example, Chris Kobach, you know, if someone were to actually talk to him just as a person to person, try to explain why this is just a really, really bad, terrible, no good idea. to what extent is trying to just convince people not only on the basis of confrontation, saying no, we can't, you're not good, you can't do this, we're going to fight you every step of the way, both legally and organizationally, but also on a personal level, like you and I are talking right now, trying to convince the idea that it's just not a good idea all around.
I once at was at a conference, was moderating a panel that had Chris Kobach on it, and I remember having lunch, sitting at the lunch table with him just before we had the panel, and this was a time when he was drafting a lot of the restrictionist legislation that ended up, for example, in Arizona and SB 1070, and I asked him, you know, you're writing all these laws like this, but we have this Supreme Court case out there, Plyler versus Doe, that says that children can go to school, K through 12, public school, regardless of their immigration status. And I, to be a little provocative, I said, Chris, why aren't you going after that decision? I don't ever hear that. And he said, oh, that just wouldn't be right. that wouldn't be a decent thing to do. You know, and so I kind of scratched my head a little bit. But I think it endorses to some extent. So, but that's the conversation I wish I had had with him. And I don't know. I think there's a lot of what the political scientists call issue entrepreneurialism here. I mean, I think there's a lot of political gain to take positions sometimes. That's true probably for people of all politics. But I mean, I think that, I don't know. Maybe, so I'm not sure how that tempers him as a person. But it was an interesting conversation, and I thought that was an interesting opening.
How do we work with spineless, phony, hypocritical leaders in this moment that want to ride this anti-Trump fad, but actually are not doing anything? And all of us may think that they're doing something because they're talking a good game, but behind the scenes, no policies are actually getting implemented.
I think that was directed to me. I mean, you know, I don't live in Los Angeles, so I'm not going to you know, cast judgment on what is happening in the community here and what the mayor has done and has not done. I just know that, you know, when the safe, so there's a piece of legislation that moved through Congress called the SAFE Act. The acronym is SAFE Act, and in essence, would have required local law enforcement to ask for immigration status when they came into contact with an individual who is found to be undocumented, and then in essence, mandated, you know, the LAPD to enforce immigration law. I just know that the most powerful and convincing messenger in those cases was local law enforcement. Because they made the case to Republicans, moderates, Democrats, that the trust that they needed to have with the local immigrant community relied on the fact that they were not seen as enforcing immigration law. And that, I think, is, you know, I'm not saying that's for every organization to say or for every person to say, but I think we have to understand that, you know, that is a reality that, you know, many Americans face, and that they believe that their police chief and their sheriff took an oath to serve and protect the entirety of their community. So let's take advantage of that understanding and that belief and advance a policy proposal and a policy strategy that serves the interests of the immigrant community, whether they're documented or not, and along the way keeps everybody else safe.
Let me just say also, Andres, I share your concern about the larger concern you raise, which is the fad question, right? I mean, I think that one of the things I think back, looking back at some things immediately post 9/11 is how quickly, maybe this is what we're talking about, the trigger moment, right? I mean, how quickly things can shift. And part of what the work I think needs to be done is to guard against that shift when it would happen. There's a critical mass of weight that can be mobilized against that shift in anticipation, because I do think that there is a faddish quality to all kinds of things, including what you've identified here is kind of a fad. I don't know if it is a fad. I certainly hope it's not. But I think that's something to be very vigilant about.
My name is Patricia Takayama, and I wanted to ask a question about the privatization of information. And assuming that to some degree that a lot of this information is being consolidated under the Immigration Department, that is there some approach that the public can take to help ensure or defend against any movements within the Immigration Department that will allow them to be more discretionary and in determining what kinds of things are enforced? And is there anything that we can do about suppressing those inclinations?
I think it's a great question, and I just wanted to comment. I saw Oliver Stone. Again, I think it was probably on CNN, which I've been watching a lot lately. But his claim was that these 15 or 16 agencies are not sharing information. I think that it's a reasonable conjecture to look at something like immigration, ICE, and these various other immigration-related agencies, and suspect that that is a that's a very good possible point of consolidation. But Stone was arguing that they're not consolidated at this moment.
Yeah, one of the biggest concerns really is the information that was gathered through Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals and DACA that was, where confidentiality was promised, but with the caveat that, the terms of this might change. A lot of people, of course, relied on this. And so right now there's a firewall of some kind between agencies, but we don't know what's going to happen with that. This is not a complete answer in the sense of something I recognize it's a very small step, but I'm thinking about the story of racial profiling in this country and sort of what was used to put the brakes on that. And a lot of this was, I think a lot of this was through legal action, but a lot of it was through information, a lot of it was through transparency, enforced by the public and by the community, and saying, like, what exactly are you doing? It turns out that that type of disclosure and then information gathering did a couple things. One is it put a lot of pressure on people in decision-making postures, and the other is that whether or not it applied pressure, it destroyed some myths. And it could be the myth that we're not doing this, or it could be making it more clear, for example, that the number of Latino immigrants who are picked up are greatly higher than the proportion of the undocumented population. These are just facts, and sometimes I think that can be just as effective independent of legal action, but often in support of legal action, but not necessarily in support of legal action, often independently.
And I would just add that in terms of the DACA program that Hiroshi referenced, if Trump moves forward to rescind or repeal that program, the way that the federal government will identify these young people, it's about 750,000 young people across the country, is the data that ICE or DHS has. But I think that one of the most important impacts of the DACA program is that it led millions of Americans to realize that their child's best friend was undocumented, that the family in the pew one row over was undocumented, that the family down the street was undocumented. And that is not something that millions of Americans will be able to unremember.
Right.
And that is an incredible opportunity that if Trump does decide to rescind this program, is to remind those millions of Americans that it will have an impact on the people that they have come to know. And that's a fundamental difference from just 3 or 4 years ago.
As you were talking, one quick and small thing came into mind, but it's been very significant to me, is that we do, as citizens, have the benefit of the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act. And I think in the Japanese American community, one use of this is just to get the records on your grandpa, your uncles, and again, this is back in the 40s, but there's all sorts of great intelligence. It doesn't happen fast. The requests are very slow, very time-consuming. It takes some work to do them. But the information is retrievable through Freedom of Information. Also, even with the CIA not releasing stuff under Freedom of Information, I've been working with my partner Marilyn here and looking at collusion between U.S. Army and the armed forces of the Philippines to go after and persecute artists like Carlos Bulacan during the 1950s. So I would really recommend, if you've got a family member or an interest, Freedom of Information Act is a powerful way that I think you can get at some of the threads of intelligence work that are not only domestic, but are clearly, they're transnational.
Okay, before we end, on behalf of Zocalo Public Square, I'd like to thank our co-presenters tonight, UCLA and the Japanese American National Museum for making this program possible. I'd also like to thank all of you for joining us tonight, and we invite you to join us at the reception, which is hosted on the first floor in the Democracy Lab. We have ushers who can help you there. And of course, thank you to our moderator and panelists for sharing their time and insight with us this evening. Let's give them a big round of applause.